All right, our kids can head on out, and the youth heading out or staying in? Or the heading out? Youth are heading out too. If you are a junior high or high school, want to be a part of the youth, they're heading out. All right. Oh man, I'm really excited. There's this many people. I thought there was gonna be like three people here. Whenever you have these long weekends, you don't think anyone's gonna show up. So I'm glad to have everyone here. I really should have prepared a sermon. I'm just kidding. We're actually going back into the Gospel of John this week. 2 weeks ago, we started in the Gospel of John, as you remember. If you were here, you may not remember. It may have been a very forgettable talk, but we were in the first chapter of John. And if you were here, you might remember that we talked about kind of how unusual John is compared to, there's four Gospels, right? Three of them are called the Synoptics. They kind of follow the same kind of lines. And then you have the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John, which is an incredible book, but it doesn't bother itself with a lot of the other stories and things the other Gospels do. Like, there's nothing about stars or Bethlehem or shepherds or stables. There's nothing about, no real build-up to anything, no background. We have the opening chapter, which has got this really big kind of grand philosophical talking. And then we jump right into Jesus, who already has disciples and he's doing miraculous stuff. Which is what we'll get into tonight. But you'll remember in chapter 1, we talked about how John uses these words that are kind of weird to us, but would have been very common back then, right? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God, right? And then the big one in verse 14 of that, where it says, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we talked about how that was a kind of a play on Greek philosophy at the time. Back in those days, they thought there was this kind of overarching truth that was kind of out there in the universe someplace, this kind of enlightenment that if you really were very wise and you thought very hard and talked with the right kind of people and learned the right kind of things, eventually you could access this knowledge that was out there someplace, this logos, right? And the logos was good and pure and noble, and it was worth our time, and so people sat around and scratched their chins and tried to access the logos, right? But the logos was important and pure, but what happened down here on earth was meaningless, and it was impure, and you know, it was too fleshy and all that kind of stuff. And so there's this real separation of things, this dualism that happened in Greek life. And so when John says, in the beginning was the Word, was logos, is the Greek term, and the logos was God and was with God, everyone would have been going, yeah, that's right. Hey, this guy understands how things work. And then you get down to verse 14, and John says, and the logos became flesh and dwelt among us, right? And that thing that was perfect and beautiful and otherworldly became flesh. That would have been something where all those who are really steeped in the Greek philosophy would have gone, nope, we're out. That is not how it works. There's no way. This place is too dirty. This place is so too meaningless to have something that big and that pure come into contact with it, right? And so there was this kind of sense of everything being separated out. And we talked a little bit about the importance of knowing that God, as we understand God through Christ, one of the most essential parts of following Christ is the understanding that God is here and now. God is in the midst of what is the most mundane. God is in the midst of what we consider to be the most kind of meaningless, fleshy, of this world kind of stuff, right? And even though a lot of us grew up in Christian traditions where they talked about, you know, everything here on earth like bad and God good separate, that's really not a Christian idea, right? And so there's this grand kind of philosophical talk that happens in John 1. And then we jump right into the very first story in which Jesus is already an adult. There's no talk of Jesus when he's a kid or being born. There's no like calling of the disciples by the riverside or any of this kind of stuff, right? Jesus is already an adult. Jesus already has disciples, although his kind of public ministry doesn't really start till right here. And John chooses a story that none of the other Gospels tell. Right, so if they had access to all these stories, right, and you can't tell all the stories of Jesus because then the books would be way too long. And so as you're kind of editing these stories, you're pulling different stories out. No one else thought this story was all that important, but John starts with it. Like, he loves the story, and it's a weird story, to be honest with you. And it's one that it was very problematic, at least in my tradition growing up. In fact, I didn't hear this preached on a lot because it involved Jesus making wine. And we just really couldn't handle that whole Jesus bootlegging thing. And so, we talked our way around it in a lot of different ways. Like one thing that I remember them kind of preaching when I was young was like, well, it says wine, but wine back then isn't the same as wine now. Anyone ever hear that whole thing? You know, like it didn't really have as much, it wasn't the same thing, which is utter nonsense. That does not make sense. In fact, this whole story implies that people had too much to drink. I mean, it's kind of one of the underlying bases of this thing. Like, maybe it was slightly less alcohol content, but you could definitely have too much of that wine, right? I mean, it's the Bible addresses, it tells us not to get drunk, not to be out of control, right? It wouldn't tell us not to get drunk if the wine couldn't make us drunk. So, I mean, there's this, you know, way we try to dodge around it, but we're not going to dodge it today. We're just going to walk right into it. This is in here. This is in Gospel John, and the story is such a unique and interesting story. I'm excited about talking about it. So, again, it may be a little problematic depending on where you're coming from or kind of, you know, what tradition you're from, but just bear with me. And in the end, if you're offended by it, you know, blame Jesus or John, not me, because I didn't make it up. So let's go ahead and talk through the verse. We're going to stop a few times on the way through here just to give you some background and context. And then I want to get to really kind of one specific little point here, because there's a whole list of things we could talk about from the story and interesting questions and stuff I don't know the answers to and all kinds of things going on here. But let's go ahead and start. John chapter 2. So this is, again, the first miracle and the first story of Jesus, really, in John. It says, on the third day, a wedding took place at Cana of Galilee. So let's stop there real quick. Say, okay, that seems pretty straightforward. Why do we have to stop there? Well, you should know that a wedding, when they talk about a wedding there, it's not the same thing we think about as a wedding. Now, there is like a ceremony and all of that. But at our weddings, we tend to do like we do a wedding, and then maybe there's a ceremony, and the ceremony is a nice thing you want everyone to come to. But if you're the bride and groom, you want people to come for like an hour, maybe 2 hours, then you want them to get out of here because you want to go on your honeymoon, right? You don't really want to hang out with everyone. You just got married. In fact, it can potentially be like the longest couple hours of your life. They didn't like go do honeymoons back then. What they did was they got married, and then the family would throw a party, and that party would last like sometimes 7 days, right? I mean, you're talking about a throwdown party. If anyone's engaged in here, you may want to consider it as an option. I don't know if you have an extra couple $100,000 to make it just last an entire week. But, I mean, it was like all the neighbors came. Tim told me he'd been setting it aside since you were young. Just go ahead, 7-day party. You should be fine. and so don't worry. If you're anything like these people, you won't remember after day two. So it's fine. But I mean, it's a big time party, right? I mean, it goes on, and the celebration goes on and on and on and on and on, right? And so just understand that's kind of the context. It's not like there was a 2-hour reception, and then, you know, we're going to get ready to find out they ran out of wine, and, you know, they just didn't plan well for the 2 hours. Now, this is like days that we're talking about here. So, you know, they run out of wine. So a wedding takes place in Cana of Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." You'll notice like twice now, right, they've said Jesus' mother instead of Mary. Nowhere in the Gospel of John does he ever mention her name. Again, there's weird details and things that John just doesn't have any time for. He doesn't care about. Doesn't tell any stories about Mary when she visits from the angel and that kind of stuff. It's just Jesus' mom, right? It says Jesus' mother, which is kind of an interesting thing there. And then it's also interesting how he replies. They have no wine. "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." Now, as we read this in English, if you're anything like me, and I'm a mama's boy, I was taught to always be respectful, this seems like Jesus is kind of being a jerk to his own mom right here, right? Like, I don't encourage you to try this next time your mom asks you for something. Just go, "Woman, I don't know who you're talking." Like, don't do it. It won't work. In the original language, the original context, this is not rude. Now, it's not warm. It's certainly not the most familial term he could have used, right? But it's not rooted in any of that kind of stuff. Just to give you that. But, and Jesus replied, "My hour has not yet come." Now, this is one of those weird little phrases in here where we're not, at least I'm not, and there's lots of theories out there, I'm not entirely sure what this means, right? Because presumably, we learn later he already has disciples, which means he's already done some calling of people. He's already gotten some public aspects a little bit to maybe his ministry, even if most people don't know him yet. There's maybe been some miracles potentially that have happened, even though there's the first one John said. We're not really sure what this means. In some sense, Jesus is saying, "Hey, I shouldn't be doing this right now," right? Which also indicates that Mary knows full well that he can do something about it. Which, do any of you just wish we had some stories about Jesus when he was like younger? I mean, like we skip from like baby to 30, even in the synoptics, right? I mean, at some point, did he do something around the house? I just wonder, like, he did something around the house that Mary and Joseph were like, "What the, you know, there's no way you're done cleaning your room yet." He's like, "Oh yeah, check it out." You know, and it's been 5 seconds. How did, you know, I feel like there's gotta be something cool have happened. But anyways, he says, "My hour is not yet come." And so that's a little bit of a vague sentence, but he's at least seemingly hesitant to go forward with this, with helping out with the wine that is gone. And then Jesus' mother does what mothers are entitled to do, which is totally ignores her son and says to the servants, do whatever he tells you, right? She says, you know, look, mom, or actually a woman, my time is not yet here. Like, you know, I shouldn't be doing this. She's like, okay, hey, y'all just do whatever he tells you to do and then leave. So she's kind of, he'll do it. I love that. I think that's very motherly right there. Nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by Jews for the ceremonial washing. Each one held from 20 to 30 gallons. So 6 jars, each one 20 to 30 gallons. And they were the kind that held this water. And so, again, we should stop here. And this, to me, is one of the most key parts of this whole story, at least the part that kind of lights me up for whatever reason when I'm reading it. These are the jars that they're going to use to ceremonially make themselves pure, right? You may not know much about the Jewish religion, particularly back then, but there is a long list of things you do and don't do, a long list of things that make you impure, and a long list of ways to make yourself pure again. This is a very important part of their faith. It's a very important part of their religion. If you've never read through the Old Testament, if you've never read through like Leviticus or anything, I encourage you to do it, but make sure you have some caffeine. It's hard to get through, but I mean, there's a long list of things, right? They take this stuff very seriously. They get into way more detail than I'm comfortable sharing with you about how to stay pure and what makes you impure and all kinds of stuff. And so this was what, these jars were there so they could ceremonially do what they need to do to still separate themselves as good people of God, to show themselves as holy and pure and participate with everyone else without making everyone impure. So these have very big religious significance in these. It's not just kind of jars that were there. They're very important religiously to them. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now, right? So he's basically congratulating this guy because he didn't pull kind of the dirty trick that all of us would pull if you're planning a budget for this kind of, you know, shindig, which is, I bring out the really tasty stuff now, right? The choicest of everything. And then once everyone is good and liquored up, and they don't even really, can't really hardly even stand up, then you start giving them the garb. And that's fine, it works well. I'm not encouraging any of you to drink a lot, but I'll just say the line at Taco Bell is not that long at 2 in the morning because people don't want gross things after they've had too much to drink, right? So, I mean, you know, your standard's lower the more you drink. And I'm sure none of you personally are familiar with that, but I've studied it sociologically, and that's right here happens. So, but you've waited till now, and you're bringing out this is the best tasting stuff we've had, right? And you're bringing it out now. He stayed the best till now. What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of signs through which he revealed his glory, and the disciples believed in him. So this is the first of the signs for the disciples, according to John, where they really began to realize that there's something to this guy, and they believe in him. After this, he went to Capernaum with his mother, brothers, and his disciples. There they stayed for a few days. So for some of you, this, again, depending on what you kind of grew up with and where you're at personally, this story may make you feel a little uncomfortable because, you know, Jesus giving wine to drunk people, and I understand that, and I get that. Some of you love it right now and are trying to find a way to use this as an endorsement for whatever you already did this weekend, and I understand that. Some of you are hoping we're using real wine tonight as part of communion, but we didn't. In keeping with the story, I just filled them with water. The cups are filled with water. We're just going to let God do whatever God wants to do, so y'all just pray about that. But what's kind of most interesting to me is, I mean, I love this story. There's so many different things going on here, and there's some really interesting ideas happening. And it's fascinating to me that the writer of John, out of all the stories, this is what he starts with. And he places it right between that really big philosophical conversation about the Word and the Word becoming flesh and these kind of big, grandiose ideas. And then the very next story that we find in John is Jesus clearing the temple, which the Gospel of John puts right at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, whereas everyone else puts it right before Jesus was killed, right? But John tells that next. And so, as much as you can kind of get into the weeds and all the different things of this, I think there's a point being made here. And there is a lot of questions that are raised in this. So let me go ahead and tell you some of the things I'm not going to tell you about tonight. I'm not going to answer for you tonight, in case you had that question as we were reading through it. The question of why was Jesus hesitant? That one kind of annoys me about the story. Like, why did Jesus have to be kind of prodded to be generous in this situation? That part, I don't quite get it. I don't understand why it works like that. So if you're looking for an answer to that question, sorry, too bad. I don't have one for you. I don't know what it is. What exactly is his hour? Right? What does that mean? It's not my hour yet. And does it become his hour at a certain point in there? Or does he change his mind? Does he basically just become like a good Jewish boy who's going to listen to his mom? Or does it suddenly become his time for some reason? Maybe it becomes his time because suddenly there's people there who listen to him and will do what he says, right? Which his mother tells people to do. I don't know. Those are kind of interesting ideas to me. I don't know the answer to. Again, did Mary force his hand? Was he just being a good son to his mother? As I was studying on this, I was reading some people, which makes me a little uncomfortable, that tried to kind of like extrapolate out of this like a kind of a model for prayer, how like God's kind of sitting in heaven and he's got this, you know, abundance of what he wants to give out, but he's just waiting on someone to kind of say, hey, you know, you need to do this, and then he'll do it. That makes me feel a little weird. I'm not so sure about that. I'm not sure I'm down with that kind of theology, although there may be some truth to it, but I don't really know. Those things I'm not really sure about, to be honest with you. But as I look at the positioning in the Gospel of John, as I look at the story of what's going on here, there is one really interesting portion of this, I think. And I think what John is trying to do here is establish Jesus' relationship with religion in general, at least religion in his context, right? As there's kind of that larger conversation in chapter 1 that paints this big, huge picture of who Jesus is and in the grand scheme of the history of the world, and then you have Jesus really going into the temple and turning over the tables, and you have this moment with these jars that have such religious significance that Jesus really kind of turns on its head. It seems like John is trying to establish something about this. That image of the jars is what gets me, right? Because these jars are reserved for purity, right? It's symbolic of this history, of this practice of things, of these rules, of these ways of going about things that separate the holy from the unholy, right? And this is really a role that religion serves a lot. If you've been here for any amount of time, you've seen me use these little diagrams before, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them here, but let's go ahead and pull up that first circle. You can talk in kind of sociological terms about different sets of people, different groups of people, and they have different groups that they call bounded and unbounded sets, right? Some of you guys have, again, seen me talk about this before. But what you have a lot of times in religion is a bounded set, which works like this. So, because you know it's easier to talk about other people than us, let's talk about other people. So you have maybe those who are involved in the Jewish religion during Jesus' day, right? And you have those that are inside the circle, those that are a part of the community. And the way they become a part of the community is all these things that they don't violate that create the boundary, right? So you don't eat certain things. There's dietary laws. You obey the Sabbath. You have this shared ethnic history. You go to the festivals and take part in the fast. You have these ritual purity that you do, circumcision, you know, whatever, all these different things, right? And there's a way for you to know who's in and who's out, right? It's a bounded community. So I, as a good Jewish male during that time, can look at someone else and say, hey, you're not doing this, you're not doing this, you're not doing that, you're not part of our group, right? Now, if you want to do all those things, if you want to go through all the steps and do all those things and whatever, you can become a part of things, right? You can become part of a group. It was kind of a tough sell once you got to the circumcision part, but I mean, it happened, people did it. You can become, but it's a bounded, there's a set of boundaries, right? I had those, we had this, our own version of that in the church I grew up in, right? There's certain things you did do and didn't do. You could get out of the group in a hurry if you wanted to, right? I mean, you didn't drink, you didn't smoke, you didn't cuss, you didn't hang out with people that did, you didn't sleep around, you didn't, and then there's a lot of things, you know, then it got weird, and it was like you don't dance for some reason, I've never figured out why, but you weren't allowed to dance, you weren't allowed to do a lot of things, right? And if you did any of these things, we called it backsliding. And what backsliding meant was I was in the circle and then whoop, now I'm out of the circle, right? Now if I do the right things, I say the right things, I can get back inside the boundaries and then I'm back in again, right? This is something that traditionally I would argue religion mostly does, right? And that's part of what these jars represent. It is a way to purify yourself to be in the group. It's a way to get inside the boundaries again. These jars represent one of the ways in which a group of people builds a wall that keeps some people out and lets some people in. And again, you've probably had your own version of that. It is how you distinguish yourself from others. It's how you put distance between us and them. It's how we know who is holy and who is not. It's the way religion tends to work. This is the way it's worked in my life. But what you find with Jesus really has no time for this, or that gives no credence to this way of operating in the world. In fact, Jesus basically just says, follow me. I mean, and that's really it. Follow me. Right? It would have been much easier. Jesus could have just given us a list of 15 rules, right? He could have just told us what the boundaries were. And then we wouldn't have all these denominations, we wouldn't have all this fighting going on, we wouldn't have all these questions, right? If he would have just given us those 15 things, then we could all abide by them and get inside the group. But that's not what Jesus does. Jesus says, just follow me. Which makes Jesus, and I'm not going to spend much time on this at all, but here's the next little thing. It makes Jesus more of a, like, I think Jesus creates what's called a centered community. So there's not boundaries that you can't violate, otherwise you get kicked out or you have to obey to get in. Jesus just says, look, here I am, follow me. And it doesn't matter who you are, right? If you're a widow, orphan, apostle, prostitute, tax collector, king, prophet, priest, Samaritan, it doesn't matter who you are. If you walk this direction, we're going together. It's one of the reasons we've chosen as a community that we use that phrase, we're simply following together, right? What that means is no matter who you are, no matter where you're at, there's no being inside or outside our walls. There is none of that. There is this person of Jesus that we believe is worth following. Wherever you are, take steps towards him, you're with us. You're walking with us, right? We're simply following together. And I think that this thing that Jesus does, this miracle at this wedding, is a move from the bounded to the centered. It's no accident that Jesus takes these symbol of purity, of separation, and of holiness, and he uses them to open up the party a little more for everybody. Right? He uses them to open up the party. Jesus uses it to give to everyone what is the best that he has to offer, his abundant generosity. These same jars now become a source of gratuitous generosity, an abundance of good things. And this feels like a very different spirit from what the jars were intended to be, doesn't it? It's the difference between separation and inviting everyone to the celebration. It's the difference between being a wall builder and a wine pourer. And I think it's a signal to us about the kind of people, the kind of followers Jesus wants us to be. Have you noticed that we as people of faith are kind of famous for being such downers all the time? I mean, there's very few people who are like, you know what, we got to get a bunch of Christians in here to this party, liven this thing up. Right? I mean, I've never heard that phrase before. No one ever calls me and says, hey, look, I'm sorry, we're having a party, we don't have a preacher yet, so we know it's not going to be fun until we get one there. No. Now, 150 times in my life, I've walked up to a conversation and they're like, man, that was so much fun. Preacher. No, we had a Bible study at the house is what we were doing and gotten left out way more than I've been included in things. Because the assumption is that you're going to be kind of a downer on everything, right? We have this, we've kind of got this tradition of mistrusting too much celebration. I mean, we definitely mistrusted celebration in my church growing up. I mean, definitely, right? I mean, you never danced at party. There was never wine at our weddings. There's none of those things, right? You had to avoid. You weren't even allowed to celebrate in church, right? I mean, if there was a good song, if they would have sang that song that they sang tonight in my church, and someone would have clapped, they would have been on the naughty list for clapping. I mean, you don't do that in our church, right? I mean, that's a little gaudy. Just clap in church. I mean, we'd so distrusted. And we would sing these hymns of these like grandiose themes of just like, how blessed we are and how much God loves us. And they're all, we all looked like dead while we were singing them because you couldn't celebrate. Like, it makes zero sense. I mean, after all, if what we say is actually true, if we actually believe it to be true, if Jesus is God incarnate, if love is unconditional, if grace abounds, if forgiveness is available, if fill in the blank, if all these things, why wouldn't we be celebrating? Why wouldn't we be the life of the party? Why wouldn't we be smiling? Why wouldn't we be celebrating instead of separating? Why wouldn't we be pouring the wine instead of building the walls? How many of Christ's teachings and parables how much throughout, especially the New Testament scripture, how much of it is centered around a banquet table? How much is about having a party? How much is about inviting people in and feeding the best foods and drinking the best wine? How much is it a celebration of the good gifts that God gives us here and now? Why does Jesus talk about that all the time? Right? Because in the end, this is a feast, and it's not a feast that's there because I'm so pure I've deserved a party and God threw it for me. It's not a feast about my purity. It's about God's reckless and abundant generosity to all of us. It's about God taking even the tools that we use to separate ourselves from others and making the best wine out of it for whoever wants to drink it. It's about God's generosity. So why are we so bad at this when it comes to religion? Why aren't we the first ones celebrating the abundantly good gifts of God that He gives to us on a constant basis? Why aren't we just not able to shut up about the gifts we are given? I mean, all the time and energy we spend comparing ourselves to others, all the religious purity that, I mean, it looks different for us than it did for them, but we've still got our own stuff. All the calories we burn on comparing ourselves to others, when the religion of abundance is right here. Religion of abundance, where we can't stop being thankful for what we already have. One is about grace and love. One is about misery and performance. I love that the first miracle happens at a wedding. I love that He turns water into wine, because I think it says something about the nature of God. And I can promise you, if you spend a little less of your life on the downtrodden, woe is me, comparison of yourself to others and all the things that you can come up with that maybe you don't have, and a little more time celebrating the abundant goodness that God has already shown you, I promise you'll enjoy your life a lot more. God is good. God is generous. God has given us more than we ever deserve. Why should we be wall builders and not wine pourers? It's hard to do. I don't know why I fall off this so much. It's so easy for me to get into the other lane for some reason. But it is about celebrating the good gifts of God. And in this story, what I like the kind of the way the story ends up is the one thing that really designates a follower of Christ in this story. The one thing that designates a disciple from the rest of the crowd is not that they're more pure, it's not they obeyed the rules better, it's not that they're better people or better performers. They enjoy the same abundant gift everyone else does. They just recognize the source of the abundance and they act accordingly. And that's what it means to be a disciple. We know where it comes from and we act accordingly. We stop building our walls and we start pouring our wine. We stop excluding and we start celebrating. We believe and follow the Jesus who gives and gives abundantly. Because each of us is a recipient of so many good gifts. Why should we not be up in this party? Let's pray. Thank you so much for being here tonight. And allow me to say this, I hope it goes without saying, but just in case there was any misconstruing it, this was not a Jesus told me to go tie one on tonight sermon. That was not the point. I know some of you hate wine. Some of you don't drink it. Some of you having a drink of wine right now would be the worst possible decision you can make. And we understand that. It's about understanding where our good gifts come from. It's about celebrating those things. It's about being a people that welcome other people to the table to see who the giver of all good gifts are. And so that's what we are called to be. We are called to be people who celebrate. It doesn't have to be literal wine, but we should be pouring out God's goodness in this world. So as we leave this place, may we remember where all good gifts come from, and may we be carriers of that good news, and may we be inviting people to the banquet table of God. As you go into this week, remember, you are the recipient of many good things. So let's invite others to the table. Peace be with you. Have a great week.